This is NASCAR driver Tony Breininger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
Hey everybody, Ethan here. Since we're doing the movie Twister today, I actually got a hold of the singer of the band Twister, Scarlett Tripp. How you doing, Scarlett?
Hi, thanks for having me on your show.
Absolutely. So I heard a little rumor from a little birdie that you named your band after this movie. So is this like your favorite movie?
No, I don't know what movie you're talking about. Twister is actually this kid that I knew growing up. But I'm here to talk about the album.
Did you have a new album out or?
Yeah, thanks for asking. Twister's new album is called Ride High or Die. And it's really a transformative piece. And if you know our previous works, it's kind of a regression to that sort of sound.
Cool. I don't know a lot of your work. I kind of thought that we were just going to talk about Twister today, the movie. And I don't know if you had any memories with it. Are you aware of the movie with Bill Paxton?
It's funny that you bring up memories because that's track two. Memories was written by me and Scott Dode. And we really based that song off of real memories we had at an amusement park.
That's fascinating. So let's hear a little a clip from that song.
Sure, go ahead. I think that's all we can legally play.
Oh man, that's a shame because it was a really enticing little clip.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for being here, Scarlett Tripp. And I hope that you get a chance to see the movie because it's really fun. It's about a bunch of tornadoes, tornado chasers.
No, I appreciate that, but I won't.
Bad science. Did the movie get it right? Bad science. Or will we have to fight?
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Bad Science. This is your host, Ethan Edinburgh. This is the show where we break down the science of a movie with comedians and scientists. And today is no exception. Why would it be an exception? Could you imagine if today we just didn't do that at all and I just ran through my grocery list? Anyways, we're talking about Twister, 1996's Twister. A fantastic film. I've been waiting to do it for a long time. We've had many requests to do it. And finally, the day has arrived. Joining me, I have some fantastic guests. First, he is the senior scientist of the Forecast Research and Development Division of the National Severe Storms Laboratory. It's Dr. Harold Brooks.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Harold. How are you feeling?
Well, you know, nervous and with trepidation is what's about to happen to me in the next little while.
Yeah, good. That's how I like my scientists, because today you're going to get all twisted up.
I'm ready.
I don't really know what that means either.
You aren't supposed to.
Yeah, yeah. This is all just off the cuff. This is not a scripted podcast for those that were concerned about that. To help me today, I have two wonderful writers and podcasters, RJ Theinman and Aaron Blayart.
Hi.
Hey guys.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely.
I thought we were going to do a thing where like we take turns speaking, but I guess RJ and I are just speaking the same time.
No. I speak over Blay. Pretty much the whole time.
If you guys
time.
Could do it in harmony, that would be ideal.
Oh, yeah, you know what? Yeah. RJ, you know what? It's funny you we bring will. That up. I'm glad you brought that up because RJ is in an a cappella troupe. RJ, give us
what?
A couple bars or something. Yeah. You know, sing us a little like Twister theme real quick. Go
yeah,
for it.
Yeah, please.
We don't need Twister
just
themes,
do it.
But
you
I
know
am,
just do it.
That is
just
true.
Do it.
I am in a barbershop quartet. We're called We Four Kings, and we do exclusively Christmas shows.
So just give us a little Twister. Give us a little taste. Give us a little taste, dude.
I watch out for the tornado. Yeah, pretty good,
oh
huh?
Whoa. And so you sing the soprano good. Parts, I gather.
No, I just came out with that one just now.
Whoa. Unbelievable. Okay, well, I can't wait to remix that. But before that point, we are talking about Twister. I want to get your guys' takes on this film. We spoke very briefly before the pod, so I'm going to start with you, RJ. You were saying that you watch this monthly. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah, at least. Yeah, yeah. It's on television probably daily, if not every other day. And I catch it.
And if not, it should be.
Yeah, and I catch it most of the time. But I will say that I went back and watched it again last night because I haven't seen the beginning in years. But I usually catch like the second half of the movie.
Right.
And it's one of my favorite movies. This movie changed my life more than maybe any other movie.
Why? In what way?
Oh, man. I mean, I don't know if we should just totally go into this.
How long? Yeah.
How long do you have? This is like a 4-hour podcast?
I've got all day.
Can you just keep it to 2 sentences, dude? Jesus.
Yeah, in 2 sentences, how did Twister change your life more than any other film?
Short sentences, sentences.
When I was a little kid, I was scared of dorms. And I'm so stoked to talk to Harold, by the way. But when I was a little kid, I was really scared of thunderstorms. So much so that my parents even were worried about me, and they sent me to a therapist, okay? My therapist told me that to get over being scared of storms, I should have thunderstorm parties. So I would sit in the garage with like chips and soft drinks with my parents and watch severe weather outside of our house. And one time we saw a tornado. And
where was this?
I grew up in Kentucky. Okay. It freaked me out. It was amazing. But then this movie came out and I was like, oh my gosh, I think I want to be a storm chaser.
You totally 180'd.
I know. And I almost I almost went to Purdue to study meteorology, and I wanted to be a storm chaser, but instead I decided that was much too dangerous and I should just go into the entertainment industry.
I should stick to a cappella groups.
Yeah, a cappella groups mainly.
Yeah. I mean, from that excerpt, you made the right choice, clearly. That song is incredible, brought me to tears, Grammy worthy. So that's great. So on one side, we do have you as Twister's a top 5 film, it sounds like. That's great. I love when we have a huge fan of the film. Aaron or Blay, or as you self-proclaim, most handsome man in Los Feliz.
Thank you.
How do you feel about Twister?
First of all, I want to say John Hamm also lives in Los Feliz, so him and I are in competition for most handsome man. RJ, quickly, how many weather apps do you have on your phone? And don't lie. How many do you have? How many do you have?
Hold on. I'm looking right
now. He doesn't even know offhand, by the way. Can I just say that? It's so many he doesn't even know.
Is this an issue? Like when you guys are hanging out, do you find him just checking multiple apps? Is
I
that
do.
Why?
Okay. But, yeah.
I don't check them. They just go off and interrupt. I have 12 weather apps.
Yeah. Oh my God. Hold on. I want to jump. Harold, do you have multiple weather apps, or does this sound excessive to you?
It sounds excessive to me. Yeah. I do have, I'm sorry. I have multiple. I have a radar. I have a radar app, and I have the Oklahoma Mesonet app. And then one of the local TV stations, and a weather radio app. So I think I've got 4.
Harold has 4.
Harold, do you have my lightning tracker? Cause I think you need that.
No, cause that's on my radar. I've got lightning on my radar, on the radar app. Yeah.
That's how a professional does it, RJ.
So clearly RJ's a freak. Aaron, what did you think of this movie?
I love Twister. It's interesting. I think, I love Philip Seymour Hoffman, RIP. You know, it's not a huge fan of Helen Hunt, but she pulls it off here. I will say one thing about Twister. Yeah, no. One thing about Twister is I was really scared of The Shining. Mm-hmm. When I saw it way too young.
Same.
So that scene where they're in the drive-in. Yeah.
That's the movie in the drive-in.
Right. I was just like, I'm watching Twister and there's that great scene where, the Twister comes to the drive-in and the twins are there. And I was like, they tricked me. I'm just like screaming because of the Shining twins. They found their way to Twister. I love it. I think Twister is a fantastic movie. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I would agree. Oh, yeah. And I think that I also maybe didn't realize how ridiculous it was at the time because I was so much younger. Now, I just literally watched it this morning and there were certain parts that, now I can pick out as being ridiculous or really silly. But at the time, I was just wrapped up in a ball of awesome.
Yeah. Also, I think it's important to think about, for me, it's important to think about the context of Twister and when it was released, because this is kind of again, CGI was fairly new at this point. I mean, Twister taken now is basically just Sharknado without the sharks. I mean, it's ridiculous, but back then it was like, oh my God, look at this these crazy effects and all this stuff. And I think it really kind of escaped B-movie, its true B-movie status.
Totally.
With the fact that when it came out, it was pretty groundbreaking in terms of what things looked like.
It also had that amazing 90s camp movie vibe where you had the ragtag low budget team, and then you had the sponsored bad guy team, which is in like every kid's 90s movie, and it, oh man, it's the best.
Yeah, I want to piggyback off that actually and ask Harold. Obviously, Harold, I want to know what you thought of the film. When did you first see it? I mean, I'm sure it had, you know, an impact one way or the other, considering your profession. But then also, I wanted to ask about that whole rivalry, because the only way that it's explained, he's talking about Jonas, you know, the bad guy who has all the black cars and how he has corporate sponsors and how he's in it for the money. And to me, after talking with so many scientists because of this podcast, I think like, but that's a normal scientist move, isn't it? To get money from grants or whatever. Isn't that what you want in able to do
your
research?
How does that make them villains?
You need to get funding to get... To do most of the work. Okay, it's probably full disclosure time.
Great.
Since you guys watch the movie much more often than I do, if you hang all the way through the credits until No Animals Were Harmed, just before No Animals Were Harmed, I'm in the credits.
What? As Helen Hunt. You played Helen Hunt, didn't you?
No, I knew it,
Harold. I knew it.
I was not Helen Hunt. I'm listed as a technical advisor. I did have a 3-hour phone call with Helen Hunt.
This is officially the most starstruck I've ever been.
Well, yeah, that I pity you.
We all pity him.
Just as background to that, I was at the Severe Storms Lab. We were actually doing a field project in 1994 and 1985, we were hosting a major field project that was funded by the National Science Foundation and NOAA, my parent organization in the federal government.
Oh, I have their app.
Yeah, and so as a
of course,
as part of the project, I was one of the leads on the project. My job was basically to stay in Norman. I did forecasting for it. But for that year, for 1995, my wife and I were expecting a child, and I said, "Well, I can't leave town at all because the baby was due in May, so that we needed somebody to do the media relations." And that fell to me in large part because some of the people at headquarters were afraid that they were going to rewrite the script to make the government look bad.
Mm-hmm.
And so they said, "Well, we're going to treat this like this was just a media interaction." I got handed this to interact with the movie people, just like I was interacting, you know, with a TV station from Peoria.
Wow.
And they came to visit the lab in... Jan de Bont, who was the director, and Joe Nimick, who was the set designer. And I can't remember who the third person came to visit us in November and in December before the movie was filmed in 1995, described what they were planning to do and what the movie was about. We did some stuff with them. We did a lot of safety training for the cast and crew.
Whoa.
Answering some questions about script. That was the whole thing with the phone call with Helen, was trying to change some of the lines that she had. Huh. And then I worked a lot with the art department coordinator, Carlin Emick, who just wanted to try to make things look right, you know, from a set standpoint. And they actually filmed the intro scene twice. Once with that, we meet out in the field and talk to, and you know, we're trying to get the divorce paper signed. But they also filmed a version of inside of a classroom, which I really would have loved to have had used, because we had made stuff for the Blackboard to show that included some inside jokes within the meteorological community.
Whoa.
That they didn't use that. That was unfortunate. And then we hosted Bill Paxton came and visited us in our operations center during he was in while I was working as the forecaster when we got our first tornado of the 1995 season. And then he went out with our field teams on April the 19th. 1995, which we didn't get a tornado. That was the day of the Oklahoma City bombing, which made operations incredibly difficult. Most of the rest of the cast went out that day with some other folks. And then they invited us. They did some of the stunt filming and some of the across the street from where the lab is. And so they invited my wife and I to come watch the filming of when the house is collapsing, where Aunt Meg is. We watched that scene being filmed. And then they did the final scene that they filmed was actually the house, the car or the truck driving through the house. And it was the part of the driving up the steps
that
was just across the street from the lab. So I watched all that kind of stuff and had to interact with people.
Wow.
Kathy Kennedy used to come and mooch coffee off of me when she came to visit the lab. So that's the full background.
Cool. That's amazing. Yeah. My God. And you were also amazing as Helen Hunt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really, really convincing.
Yeah, that was just fantastic. I mean, I don't, you know, wigs, normally I can see right through them, but that was just great.
Can I ask you a question, Harold?
Yes, you can. I don't have to answer it, but you can ask. Yes.
Yeah, that's true. No, okay, so you're in Oklahoma, right?
Yes, I am.
So you know what? You know, in the very first scene in the movie, mm-hmm. when Helen Hunt's a little, or her character's like Joe, I think is her name, is a little girl, mm-hmm. and the tornado's happening. And why is the cellar or the basement or whatever so far away from the house? Like that is that a common thing, or is that just a movie thing where the like are cellars usually that far away, like on the other side of their yard?
I wouldn't say that far away. I mean, it kind of depends. People who have shelters like that, and those aren't obviously nearly as popular as they were at one point. You know, a lot of them started off at some point as, especially in rural areas, as that was a place that you could store vegetables and things like that underground.
Okay.
But that was probably further away than most people have them. I mean, I know of a house probably 5 blocks from here, from where I live, that it's maybe 20 feet out the front door.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
And that's a lot more common than having them that far away from the house. Yeah.
But also, I wouldn't want my shelter to be near the house. If the house gets destroyed, then the debris is going to fall on the shelter door and I can't get out.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, that's an issue. And that, in fact, one of the things that we built when we did an addition onto our house, we built an in-residence, what's called an in-residence shelter in our house as part of the addition. And while it's on the living level, so that we shouldn't have this problem, most common thing now for a lot of people to do is to put a shelter in their garage underground, and you kind of slide open the door and you go underneath. And when you register your shelter with your local municipality, and they're aware of that. And so if your house is, in the damage path and is destroyed, they know that there is a shelter underground there that may be covered by debris.
Oh, that's important. That's very smart.
So look, the big issue with the outdoor shelter like that is if you don't get into it regularly and you really need it, there's that question of, are you going to go out there after dark and run to your shelter in the rain or the hail? And what kinds of creatures are living in it? We have some poisonous spiders around here in Oklahoma. We actually have rattlesnakes. And if you're looking down in the shelter and you see snakes, how anxious are you to take your chance? Yeah.
You got
to
choose between a tornado and a snake.
Oh my God, Harold, I think this is a sequel to Twister that you're writing right now.
Yeah. Throw the snakes out into the yard and get a snake-nado going,
yeah,
like all the snakes, bunch of biting snakes. I mean, I will say that's so smart though about registering, and it makes sense, like registering your underground shelter with the municipality. I mean, I should really do that with my sex dungeon. I am worried about like if debris falls on the door, no one's going to fuck it.
Sorry, Aaron, you told me to remind you not to talk about your sex dungeon on the air.
Oh, God. Oh, I always do this. You'll cut that part out, the sex dungeon
part.
No,
unfortunately, we can't cut that out. Listen, I had a question. There's a quote someone says about the cellar. They say, if you don't have a cellar or a basement, it's on the TV, actually, while the camera's moving. It says, if you don't have a cellar or a basement, go to the center of your house. Would you recommend that to people that are, in a tornado without a cellar?
The standard safety advice we offer people is you want to get as low as you can and put as many walls between you and the tornado as possible. So get into the middle, into the small interior room. We don't have a basement in our house. And before we did the addition with the in-resident shelter in it, there's a small hallway in between what at the time was were the bedrooms of the house, and that was where we went. We would close those doors, and it was maybe 8 feet by 6 feet. If we would have had a closet that was smaller than that wasn't full of stuff, that would have been better. But you just stay away from windows and get into the middle of the house with as many walls between you and the tornado as possible. I think they actually put that line in as a result of the safety message that we were trying to get out as part of the movie, because Universal was actually really good about trying to encourage safety.
Great.
Despite what goes on in the movie.
Yeah.
When they opened the Twister attraction at Universal Studios in Orlando.
Love that ride.
What they actually did was they did sort of publicity things for it, mostly at science museums around the country. And we went to the science museum and we would do a safety presentation. And then we would do the shtick was that they had a portable wind tunnel they brought around, and we'd stand in the wind tunnel with, the meteorologists from local TV stations and do an interview in, 75 mile an hour wind and rain.
Awesome. So I got to ask the big question here, which I feel like I've been wondering since I first saw the movie when I was little, which is, are people actually doing this? Are they chasing tornadoes with gadgets? And has it resulted in longer tornado warnings?
Well, I think we can say people have tried to put instruments into tornado paths and do other things for since the late 70s, early 1980s. The Dorothy thing is based off of what was called TOTO, the Totable Tornado Observatory, which was a single oil drum that the idea that it was developed at the University of Oklahoma in its Severe Storms Lab, and the idea was to deploy it in the path of a tornado. It would have instruments on it, and then after the tornado was over, you would go back and retrieve it and get the data out of it. It didn't work all that well because it's actually pretty hard to put a single thing into the path of the tornado and then be able to get out of the path. And so it got barely hit by one tornado, and they realized it wasn't as stable as they thought it would be. So that was the first thing. What people then started to do was in the 1990s, in fact, this was the field project that was going on while the movie was being filmed, was we weren't so concerned about getting measurements inside the tornado directly as we were about getting measurements near the tornado to try to get the conditions that might help us forecast better. And in fact, those have clearly helped improve forecast. I don't know if they've helped. They haven't really made the lead time longer. They've made other aspects of the warnings much more accurate. And we would have radars that would then sample within the tornado or in the very near vicinity of the tornado to do measurements with the radars rather than putting people into the path.
That makes sense.
Recently, in the last couple of years, there actually has been a project now developed by some meteorologists at Penn State University, essentially that allows them to put. You can think of them as balloons that float at a constant altitude, and they can then release sensors from it, and they can at least get them into the inflow of the storm. The tornado is a little more difficult to do just because it's a really tough place to collect data because of the wind and the debris. But they can now put a lot of instruments in and get a lot of sort of a cloud of measurements in the area. We didn't have that technology in 1995. The problem was that you might be able to see where the thing was, but you couldn't get any data from it back because it has to broadcast back. And bandwidth wasn't large enough to distinguish between all those things. We can now, I think they've now put 300 things, these little sensors.
Doohickeys, I believe, is the proper term.
Well, yeah. I just call them things. That works better. I'm not an instrumentalist, you know. So they put those out there, and we can actually start to do that now. But that's the closest we've come to it.
But has the warning time been extended, or is it still one of the shortest warnings? Because I don't have experience with tornadoes.
Right. Yeah.
I grew up in South Florida. We had hurricanes, so when these things are coming days in advance.
Right. No, the warning time really hasn't changed, and a lot of that isn't related to the physical science. We can increase the lead time for a warning without a whole lot of trouble, but we'll have a lot more false alarms. And so there's and we're not really actually sure where this should be set, but we're trying to make a balance between how many tornadoes do you warn on, and then how many do you have false alarms on? And that's the real problem. The lead time right now for a tornado, if we put a warning out before the tornado occurs, the average time is about 15 minutes. But still,
jeez.
Almost, that's just for the warning part. Now, there's a lot of other stuff that goes into forecasting that's really important. But in the 1980s, we only warned on about a quarter of all tornadoes. That's gone dramatically up. And all of the tornadoes that are very strong, or almost all the tornadoes that are strong, the ones that are much more likely to kill people, we warned on like 95% of those in advance. And so that used to only be about 30% or 40%. So that's a big deal. But we actually make forecasts that conditions will be favorable for tornadoes up to a week in advance. And we start to say, like the April 27th, 2011 tornado outbreak in the southeastern U.S., that was actually in the forecast that was likely to be a historically big day 6 days before the tornadoes happened. And so people could start making preparations. We couldn't tell you that, your small town's going to get hit, but we could say, if you live in Northern Alabama, you need to be really ready on Tuesday for what's going to happen while you're there on Wednesday, or the Wednesday, sorry, that what's going to happen while you're there. And then we start to narrow those forecasts down maybe a day in advance and say, the northern half of Alabama is the most likely spot for things. And then tornado watches come out that are sort of the next level of you really need to be making sure you're paying attention over the next 6 hours. And then warnings come out that say this particular storm is producing a tornado or will produce a tornado. You need to take your shelter actions right then, because we really don't want you sheltering a day in advance. That doesn't, you know, make a whole lot of sense. And so there's the cascade of forecasts. I think certainly the things like the field projects have helped those early forecasts a lot, and they've actually helped reduce the false alarms on the warnings. Because one of the things we've really learned is why some storms that look like they should tornado don't, and that's an important thing.
Wowzers. Okay, good. Well, it sounds like we've made, some significant improvements. That's nice. Yep. I have a bunch of other questions here, but I believe our own associate producer, Emily Feld, has a firsthand account story. Is that correct, Emily?
Kind of story, but kind of more tornado question.
Okay, bring it.
So I grew up in Denver, Colorado, lots of tornadoes there. And I remember I was in a tornado one time and the sky turned like green. And it was super rainy and floody. Why does the sky turn green? Or is that just a really weird memory that I have?
I've seen that too, back in Michigan.
Yeah, me too.
Before tornado.
Yeah. Well, I'm watching, if you two guys would have jumped in there, I could have given her a comment about weird memories, but I wasn't. I guess I can't now. Okay.
Oh, sorry. Hey, RJ, where's your green sky app? Yeah.
Okay.
Where's your green sky app there, buddy? Make it number 13 on that phone.
I'm going to make a note. I'm going to get that tonight.
Green sky.
Frequently, the storms, there is a greenish tint, and we don't fully understand. There's been some research trying to understand that, and it is a real thing, but it's mostly so that we actually, people have actually taken measurements of the wavelength of light and could tell that it is green. It is almost certainly associated with hail, not the tornado. It's almost certainly associated with hail, but we don't really understand exactly why hail does that, because it's trying to figure out how light gets scattered is hard, and taking it's really hard to take measurements in the part of the storm where large hail is falling. That tends to be
crazy,
really hard on measurement on devices. If you've got a baseball size, size hailstone falling at 100 miles an hour, most instruments don't handle that very well.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But that it's almost certainly a hail signature.
A lot of mysteries here with the tornadoes. Is that part of what keeps you going, Harold? You love a good mystery.
I like to think of it. I like to solve puzzles.
Yeah,
and just understand things and try to figure out, how can we put the pieces together, and can we find the right pieces? Because the puzzle, unfortunately, the puzzle we've been given is actually a mix of about 8 or 9 different puzzles with different boxes, and there aren't any pictures on the cover. And so, you got to figure out how to...
Awful.
Which piece even goes with which puzzle.
I hate that. I don't particularly like regular puzzles, I feel like, now that I'm thinking about it.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Hey, everyone. This is Jesse David Fox, host of Good One, a podcast about jokes. I am proud to announce that I have personally won the Streaming Wars. And there's a new docu-special on Peacock based on our own Vulture podcast. Good One, a show about jokes, follows Mike Birbiglia as he develops new material, taking audiences through the process of transforming personal stories into stand-up. Featuring interviews with Mike's family and comedy colleagues like Seth Meyers, Hasan Minhaj, and Asko Akatsuka, Good One, a show about jokes, is streaming now only on Peacock.
The break is over. Here we go, back to the show about science.
Okay, I wrote down if you have ever done this. Have you chased a tornado and,
yes,
tried to throw something in its path?
I've never tried to throw anything in its path. I used to chase reasonably often back sort of into the, through the early 90s as a hobby.
Imagining Harold chasing after, come back, I'm sorry, I love you. No, well, wait.
And really what it was that it was,
I'll change, I'll be better. I didn't mean what I said.
Yeah, I meant it, don't worry. And really it was in terms of my development as a scientist, because I started chasing when I was a graduate student.
Rebel.
A lot of what I learned in the field, you don't even actually realize you're learning. It's like I just saw things and then I compare it to the research I was doing at the time. My PhD work was at the University of Illinois trying to model tornadic thunderstorms and non-tornadic thunderstorms and what parts of the wind profile that in the environment that they formed in, what made one tornadic and what another one non-tornadic. And so you'd see things in the field and you'd see storm behavior and you could go back and think about, okay, when I do this in the model, this happens. And that relates to what I've seen in the field. And I think I asked different questions when I looked at model data because of what I had seen. So I wasn't intentionally going out there to try to learn, but it certainly affected what I got out of the model work that I did. And then the model simulations that I did, I would say, okay, well, this was this interesting behavior that we saw in the field. Can we do something that will help us understand how that happened?
You're doing it for the rush.
When I was in high school, I got on my bike when it was raining real hard one day and took my parents' camcorder.
sounds scientific so far.
And took my parents' camcorder because there was a tornado watch and decided I was going to go chase the tornado. I had no, you know, I would look up into the sky and be like, oh, maybe it'll come out over there. But anyway, I got grounded after that.
Good.
Are you still grounded?
Yeah, I think so.
And I assume, RJ, this was after watching Twister, correct? It motivated you to do this?
Yeah. Well, of course.
Great.
Yeah.
I wonder how many kids had the same experience.
He was 28 at the time.
Yeah, it was on his 28th birthday.
I'm going to get me a tornado right on videotape. Here I go. Bike, bike, bike.
He's posting about it and his mom's calling him, telling him, you're grounded. You're going to be home for a year now.
You're grounded again.
He does still live with his mother. So that is a thing.
And that's cool. Yeah. And I have no problem with that. That's cool.
They're in love.
Okay. So I didn't know before today that you had done some work on the film. Yeah. So this is now a really appropriate question. Mm-hmm. Did it seem realistic to you? Did the tornadoes, you know, is that what they look like, what they act like? I mean, we got a really descriptive...
Yeah, man. Can they pick up cows? Can they pick up cows?
Can they pick up cows? And on the inside, is there, you know, what we saw at the end, like that inner tornado ordeal?
That little double thread thing.
Well, yeah, wouldn't they be ripped apart on that pipe when that thing comes through?
Right. Yeah, what the fuck? Let's cut straight to the chase. At the end, they've got leather straps around them, and there's some pipe in the ground. They're like, oh, this runs underground. This will save us. And they're in the middle of a tornado. Can that happen?
An F5.
In F5, a finger of God.
The finger of God.
It's unlikely that strategy for safety would have been worked very well.
Exactly.
But there's a chance.
Says the guy on his bike with a camcorder.
Yes. Okay. So this is actually the other sort of tangentially related thing that I have with the movie is that in the late 1980s at Illinois, we had the National Center for Supercomputer Applications, which was at the time we had the fastest non-Defense Department computers in the world.
Sketchy.
Was it fun to play video games on? Like, how did Doom run?
Rock hard right now.
Jesus. I can hear RJ's boner through my earphones.
Well, it may be tough for me to continue now. But
it sounds like a small child weeping. It's like
But the and so that was what we did the modeling of the storms on. And one of the big things that the Supercomputer Center did was computer visualization. And because at that point, you know, the thing for us as a scientist was, you know, when I started doing, I had done climate modeling before we did thunderstorm modeling, and we essentially were looking at printouts off of a printer, and then you could do a little bit of contouring of them, and that was all you had. And that clearly there was a lot of information we couldn't get out of the model. And so the Supercomputer Center, one of their big things was to help us with visualization to understand what our simulations looked like. And they decided, I think it was 1989, that instead of showing what they had done for this one meeting of computer graphics people was the year before, had been show a bunch of snippets from different projects. They decided to really specialize on one project, and they chose the thunderstorm modeling and did this amazing graphical presentation of our data and did a lot of work that we hadn't been able to do. One of the people who was in that group but didn't actually work specifically on our project but was, you know, basically the next door to everybody who did, was a gentleman named Stefan Fangmeier, who in the early 1990s went out to Industrial Light and Magic.
Fangmeier.
Yeah, Fangmeier.
That's Stefan, the coolest name I've ever heard in my life.
Stefan Fangmeier.
Did you live in a castle? And wear a cape?
I believe
that's
he
awesome.
Probably does now. But
Fangmeier, I presume.
Stefan did the original sort of fluid model of a tornado that was shown to Steven Spielberg that enabled him to be able to say, I think we can make the movie. Because Spielberg actually bought the rights to the name Twister from a book that was written in 1975.
Hilarious.
He bought the rights with the idea he was going to do a tornado movie, but that the special effects didn't work.
Whoa.
Until Fangmeyer showed him, we can make things that look like tornadoes.
Wow.
And not in claymation. Can you imagine if it was claymation, how dumb that movie would be?
It'd be different. Big, I don't know if it'd be dumb.
I want to see that.
It'd be different.
Okay, you know what? Harold, you're right. I bow to you. Yeah. I bow to you. Yeah. And you know what? But I'm glad it's not claymation. I don't need to see a giant, like, you know, turd cone coming across the field. You know, I want to see a real tornado.
You know, we had 1939. We had Wizard of Oz with a muslin, you know, basically with a big muslin sock.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we go to the computer model. And so Fangmeyer is actually director of special effects for the movie or something, or computer graphics for the movie. He did the first tornado. And that first tornado looks pretty good. Some of the other ones.
It looks amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it looks
pretty. Which one do you hate?
By good, I say realistic. Okay.
Fangmeyer.
The problem with the tornadoes in the movie, and this has always been the hard thing for people to get right.
RJ's going to be so upset.
Getting ready to sign off.
About to go flaccid.
Is the context.
The
tornado, the storm doesn't look right.
Ah, interesting.
And so tornadoes tend to come out of a lowering off of the backside of a severe thunderstorm that we call a supercell. And the tornadoes in the movie sort of come out of this sort of large amorphous cloud base. Hmm. And that's actually the hard thing is people try to get the tornado right, but the tornadoes aren't coming out of the right part of the storm.
It's like a very good cell. It's not, they don't
it's,
get it.
It's, and some of them are pretty mediocre cells, not supercells. Yeah.
Yeah. But bummer cell.
Yeah. And that's actually been the real challenge is to get that context right. And that was the thing where really, I think that the animations really fail at that's the worst part of them is that that's not where that tornadoes don't look like they're in the right place.
Can I ask you a question not related to Twister?
You can.
So one of my favorite tornado depictions on screen is Mad Max Fury Road.
Yeah.
I felt like have you seen that movie, Harold?
Yeah, but I don't remember it.
Okay. Mm. Oh my God. Don't remember it.
Sorry.
Good Lord. All right.
I'm a lot older than you guys are. My memory has started fading.
It's your whole deal, Harold.
No excuse for not seeing great movies, Harold.
No, I didn't say not see. I said don't remember.
Oh, remember. Fair enough.
I mean, listen, I've smoked a bunch of weed, an unacceptable amount of weed, and I remember that tornado.
No such thing. But yes, anyway, there's a part of that movie where they drive in, Charlize Theron, Furious, is trying to lose, you know, Morton Joe, and they drive into this huge sandstorm, this huge, like, wall, and it is a super duper cell. And then they get inside, and then there's these massive sandstorm tornadoes swirling around. And I think, you know, that to me, the storm looked incredible and it kind of comes across the desert as a giant wall. And then B, inside there are these massive, and they don't have like that well-defined, you know, the tornadoes don't have that well-defined of cones so much as just, it looks like chaos versus in Twister, the cow thing where the cow's like floating in the air. I mean, that cow would get ripped apart, right? And it would be in a massive storm. You don't just have a thing.
Right, and the cow would be moving a lot faster than it would. I mean, it looks like it's kind of just sitting still so it can pose for the camera.
Yeah, it was coasting.
Right.
And
what about those tornadoes in the second coolest part of the movie where they're driving next to that lake and they're split off from each other?
The sisters?
Like, the sisters.
I'd never heard that word referred to with respect to tornado until the movie came out.
But has that happened before where they like form and then split off like that? Or is that just
Didn't look very realistic. I mean, you can get multiple tornadoes, but again, it kind of comes back to context. Yes, certainly storms will make multiple tornadoes, but they form in relatively relatively well-defined patterns and times and locations and relative to each other instead of that, here's one. You know, I for a tornado movie that we actually didn't get to see, my other time to interact with the movie people was the guy who directed, Chris Sanders, the guy who did Lilo and Stitch, was going to do an animated movie for Disney. That eventually became Bolt. He was removed from the movie, it was going to be originally called An American Dog, and it was going to have a tornado at the end of it. That he rescues the girl from, and all that. And they flew me out to Burbank to look at their test animations of tornadoes. And it was one of those things that one of the tornadoes looked, they showed me two different things they had done. One of them, the tornado was wonderful, but the storm, again, the storm was awful. And the other one, the storm was pretty good, but it didn't look like a very realistic tornado. And it was like, you know, I remember telling him, basically, if you combine those two, change the direction of the flow at the ground a little bit, it'll be really good. And then the movie ended up not being made that way, which was a huge disappointment to me, because that would have been, at the time, that would have probably been the best tornado, CGI tornado anybody had ever made. And I'm one of the few people who saw it.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Should we protest Disney because they didn't greenlight that tornado scene?
Or why are you trying to hide the tornado? Yeah,
well, it was, and I think it basically came down to a dispute between, my understanding, between Chris Sanders and Disney, and they decided they didn't want him to make a movie for him anymore.
They were pissed that he wasted money flying you out there.
I don't think I was the straw. I think that was about the time that was it Pixar that got involved with Disney in terms of their animation. I think that was when Pixar came in, that changed management structure on them. Was my understanding.
I have a question. So, like, when I am stirring my coffee in the morning, and I like to stir it quickly. You know, I like to get it. And
good. That's always the way to do it.
Right.
Yes.
And I'm making a tornado in a tall glass. Right. So it feels pretty easy for me to stop the whirlwind happening in my cup. Is there a way to stop a tornado by, this is a dumb question, but I'm dumb, firing like a huge boulder at it or something? Like, could you stop a tornado by disrupting the storm or something, like physically?
Wait, you drink coffee out of a tall glass?
Yeah, I like iced coffee. So I put a bunch of, I almost said cucumbers. I'm having a stroke. You put a bunch of ice cubes in it, and then, And sometimes I'll mix my coffee with protein powder. I'm happy to talk about my daily routine if that's what you want to talk about. But, Harold.
That does sound fascinating, but second, as far as the priority of fascinating, to throwing a huge boulder at a tornado. Yeah.
I just want to be clear that, you know, I remember seeing from, I believe it was despair.com, one of those important messages that there are no stupid questions.
Except for this one.
But there are a lot of inquisitive idiots. But we'll...
I'll take it.
I was hoping you would take that in the spirit that it was intended.
Of course. Insulting. Yes, I do. Thank you.
Good.
Could I, if I had a giant boulder or something?
No.
Do you know what I'm trying to
say,
though?
A huge blanket
we lower from a plane. Yeah. Would there be a way to physically disrupt a tornado? And why don't we fire boulders at tornadoes?
Because we can't. And it really comes down to looking at,
I could do it,
at how much energy is involved in a tornado or in the thunderstorm. And really the fact that it really starts with the fact that if whatever processes led to the tornado being developed by the thunderstorm and whatever processes are maintaining that tornado, they're still there because the parent thunderstorm's still there. So even if you could magically disrupt the tornado itself, it would be back almost immediately. And the scale of the energies involved are important to consider. Sort of the ballpark number is that a tornado itself, if you sort of calculate up the energy associated with the movement of the air, is roughly an atomic bomb per second. Okay.
Whoa.
But
that's crazy.
No, that's not very big, because the thunderstorm itself is on the order of a hydrogen bomb per second.
Holy
crap. They're incredible.
How is that measured? Like, when you're saying that, how is that measured? Is that like wind force
For the tornado, it's basically wind.
Whoa.
For the thunderstorm, though, the big thing is the fact that we're taking a lot of water vapor and we're changing it into cloud droplets and rain droplets. And just like you can burn yourself with steam, that's essentially what the parent thunderstorm is doing, except it's doing it over a scale that's maybe 10 miles in diameter. And thousands of feet thick. So that's the real problem, is that the amount of energy that's going on in there is sort of dwarfs the imagination. And
I hope you're back to being scared, RJ.
Could we nuke a tornado, and would that stop the storm?
Don't even know what sign of the impact it would be. That actually may intensify the storm, possibly.
Oh my God!
So you haven't tried it, though.
Can't be stopped.
No, we have not tried it, and I'm actually not sure we could get funding to try that. As well as the fact that there are people who have objections to spraying radioactive material over a large area of the country.
Whatever.
I know there are narrow-minded people everywhere. Yeah. But that's another part of objections.
I don't have to report to anybody. So Aaron, if you and RJ and I want to go out there and fucking light this thing up, I'm good.
Well, if you can get the nuclear weapons,
there we go.
You can make that stuff.
Don't tell me you're doing it.
We won't. We'll circle back after this about the nukes. But RJ, I think I cut you off. What were you about to ask?
No. I was just gonna say, kind of along the same lines. Could you do? Well, this is a two-part question that kind of ties back to the movie too. You know, all right, so at the very end when they're looking up into the tornado and it goes all the way through the clouds and they can see the blue sky, do tornadoes do that? Do they go all the way up through the clouds or do they stop kind of like in the middle of the clouds? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's a...
But my second part to that, really, before you answer that, is could you do the opposite of what they're trying to do? Could you drop something in from a plane
to
measure a tornado?
Or from outer space?
Ooh, love this question.
Okay. That's the sequel.
Yeah. Okay, so...
Space tornado!
Space NATO.
That little scene is based off of, I want to say it was a tornado in the 1940s, and I think it was in the vicinity of Keller, Texas, where there was a farmer who basically went to his cellar, and house gets blown away, and he looks up through the cellar in the middle of the tornado and sees, he says, up way high. There is some evidence that there's a clearing in the tornado, in the middle of the tornado. Essentially what's happening is that the rotational winds is essentially throwing everything to the outside.
A hurricane where you have like an eye.
Kind of like, yeah. Okay. Yeah. But there may be some descending motion in there, just like that the hurricane has. Essentially, if you stir your cup, if you do it with tea leaves, what you actually will see is you see all the tea leaves come together at the bottom, go up, and then go out in the cup, if you watch it carefully enough. And that's essentially what happens. We're sort of centrifuging stuff away from the middle of the tornado. So there's likely that there is a clearing in there. Whether it goes all the way to the top is kind of hard to say, because the tornado, how do you define where the, you know, tornado and where the parent circulation of the larger storm is that's a little bit arbitrary, and the fact that it's probably not vertical, so it's tilted, and you might not be able to see it very much. Dropping things into that would be challenging,
not impossible,
let's just say that again, because of anything you drop is going to fall vertically. And that structure probably
isn't sucked up by the NATO.
Well, it's also the fact, what's really going to happen is it's going to get pounded by the parent thunderstorm. You know, you've got,
even if it was a thunderstorm proof capsule,
it's, you know, we're talking about, you know, 70 mile an hour winds, probably vertically, winds that are faster than that in the horizontal with hail. That's a pretty tough thing to do. And there's also some concern. We do drop packages outside of storms to try to collect information about the temperature and wind structure outside of the tornado. That's done a lot, actually, in the hurricane world. And they'll even drop, I'm pretty sure they even drop things in the hurricane itself, called dropsondes, to help get information like that. But the tornadic environment is, the wind speeds, especially the vertical wind speeds, are a lot higher in the tornadic storms than they are in the hurricane. And that just makes it's a hard thing to do.
I think we have the perfect team here, because it's so difficult to make, it doesn't have to be a sequel, but just a film inspired by Twister for the modern age, where, you know, the three of us can put it together. Harold, you can secure that everything looks legit. And the story would be that we come from space and try to get as close as possible, which is going to be, you know, chaotic and dangerous, and drop something into these twisters to stop them and save lives.
I'm in.
Love that idea.
Yeah. And let's just use the tornado from Bolt.
Yeah. They didn't use it. No one's seen it.
The legit part may be hard.
Well, that's where you come in. That's on you.
Yeah.
Oh, well, as long as we have the roles.
That's not our job.
Well defined, I suppose it'll.
I have a question. My friend JD years ago wrote a script for a movie based on something I've been dying to ask an actual professional, not RJ, about. And it was a movie where a tornado goes over a volcano, and it was called Torcano.
Love this.
And then it was a bunch of, it was basically a swirling like liquid magma cone that then, eked out a path of destruction across the land. Could there be, there's like a water spout there. It could pick up sand. Could a tornado pick up lava if it was over a volcano, and how awesome would that look? The second question is obvious, but the first question, could you have a tornado pick up lava? What? I'm asking Harold.
No, that's a good question. I like it.
We're talking about tornadoes in space, and no, oh, I'm sorry. This one is a dumb question.
I like this question.
Tornadoes. We're talking about all sorts, and now,
probably not to any significant height.
All right. But it could happen, though, right? Kind of? No?
Well,
Superheated air than liquid rock.
On which planet are we talking about?
Great question.
I would like it to be on Earth, but it could be on another planet if you think that would happen on another planet.
Okay, let me tell you the thing that actually does happen occasionally. It is true that just like with forest fires, in the vicinity of volcanoes, you can sometimes get small rotating things that have some kinematic relationship to the velocity relationship to tornadoes, but they don't actually, they probably aren't in the right spot, and they probably aren't going to do a whole lot for very long. There actually are some times when just because of that hot air going up, but getting the lava up is hard, not having it cool really rapidly, because lava tends to cool and exposure to the air pretty quickly because the air is cold.
Got it. Okay. So it's a maybe. It's a maybe.
It's a probably. I hear a probably.
Well, actually, I have some good news, and unfortunately we're running out of time, so I don't have plenty of time to explain the details of this.
Oh, how convenient.
But I did look it up, and I did secure it with a few scientists, so this is confirmed that lava could get completely sucked up by a tornado, thus becoming what they call a lava tornado. And
Torcano, dude. It's a Torcano.
Well, I didn't pick the name. I mean, I guess if we're, you can call it whatever you want. This guy.
Spread the name. Torcano.
Torcano. It basically becomes a huge Torcano and will just demolish and melt anything that it comes into its path with. So, yeah, maybe, I don't know, Harold, maybe your grant doesn't cover this kind of advanced meteorology.
I hope not.
But
Can I ask Harold one more movie question that I've been dying to ask?
Please, please.
All right, so this has less to do with tornadoes and more to do with the movie. One of my favorite parts of the movie, my whole life, I've loved that the team, gives Bill Paxton a bunch of shit for turning into a TV weatherman. Is there really, like a fraternity of... is there a difference between weather scientists and do they look down on weathermen in real life?
Great question.
I don't know if they look down. Yeah, some do for sure. Some absolutely do for sure.
That's great.
I mean, I sort of think part of it is that, I recognize that when I see my local TV people, for instance, their primary job isn't necessarily to do science. Their primary job is
to look good.
Is to communicate. And so there are times when, that isn't the best scientific explanation I've ever heard. But my next door neighbor doesn't need to know the scientific details of everything going on. They need to know, here's the enough information that I can make a good decision upon and protect myself.
Yeah, they need to know, is the Torcano going to run over my house? Yeah.
Is the tornado, they don't need to know the details of, of how the lava is made. Right, exactly right, yes. But that they need to know, I should be taking protective action now.
Yeah.
And so that's the way I look at it, is that they have very different jobs. I want them to be scientifically experts as much as they possibly can, but that isn't what they get paid to do. They get paid to provide information that helps people make better decisions.
They also have the best names, like Dallas Rains, and they have great names. I've always thought my name would be Twister Jones.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Harold, if we want to know more about tornadoes and this stuff, what are some resources that we could actually look to kind of educate?
Well, the National Severe Storms Laboratory has a whole tornado section that you can get to from our front page, www.nssl.noaa.gov. There's a little section that you can go to learn about tornadoes.
Great.
For forecast information, The long range forecast is the Storm Prediction Center, and that's out to a week in advance. www.spc.noaa.gov, and they do tornadoes and severe thunderstorms out to a week in advance. And then weather.gov is the best source for warning information for your local area. And those are kinds of places that'll help you make, again, one of the big things we always think about is, what can we do to help people make better decisions to protect themselves?
Awesome.
Well, Harold, I can't thank you enough for being on the show, for helping to make Twister, and for doing your research, which keeps people safe from tornadoes. It's unbelievable.
I'm going to put that in my next work plan.
There we go.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Please do. And RJ and Aaron, you guys have an upcoming podcast. Is that correct?
We do. That's right. It's called Hear Me Out. It's coming soon.
It's basically us arguing about stuff like tornadoes.
Yeah.
So well, look for it wherever podcasts this fall.
Great. Well, sign me up. I assume it's here, like I hear with my ears.
Correct. Sure.
Yes, it's audio only. They won't let me do a video podcast because of the handsomeness.
Ugh, that is a shame. If there's something I can sign up and protest that, please let me know.
Me and John Hamm, Los Feliz's most handsome men. Thank you, guys. This was a pleasure.
Yeah, this was awesome. Thanks so much.
I enjoyed it.
Absolutely. Can't wait to have you guys back for Torcano or for Space Chasers. But yeah, thank you for joining me and see you next time.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, see Ethan.
Ya. Take care.
Bad Science is hosted and produced by me, Ethan Edinburgh. Our associate producer is Emily Feld. Our engineer is Jeremy Schmidt. Bad Science is edited by Lucas Bollinger, and our social media is managed by Blue Whale Media. Shout out to EJ and Kate. I love you. Don't tell my girlfriend.
And the executive pro Dorothy Deucer is Brett Kushner.
Oh, follow us on Instagram at BadSciencePod. If there's a movie you'd like us to discuss on the podcast, feel free to email at badscience@seeker.com. That's badscience@seeker.com. And please leave us an iTunes review. Give us 5 stars. I sound like an Uber driver. But it does help. It makes sure people know about the podcast, which we really appreciate. Thanks for listening. Bye.